TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Richard Grossman, when injustice is legal, what do the abolitionists teach us about challenging corporate rule? This program is in remembrance of Richard Grossman, who died of cancer in November 2011. He was one of the great, uncompromising, courageous thinkers and activists in the unfolding project to define, limit, and abolish corporate power. Richard Grossman was one of the first historians who called attention to the fact that corporations have become persons under the 14th Amendment, an amendment that was to protect the rights of freed slaves. Since 1868, corporations have greatly expanded their constitutional privileges into the First, Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. Combined with their huge economic clout, they now are more powerful than people. And Grossman said that today we are living in a corporate state, not in a democracy. He wrote, "If we are going to have pretense to democracy, we cannot give political rights and powers to a private entity. We cannot let that private entity get so strong that it rewrites the laws, that it shapes the culture, that it shapes the education. It may be difficult to imagine a country that's not dominated by giant corporations. But other people before us have imagined that and left us many important mechanisms that we can use." End quote. Richard Grossman rediscovered the amazing history of the abolitionists, and this talk answers the question what it is that we can learn from them today. Richard Grossman spoke in Yellow Springs, Ohio in November 2006. At that time, he was working with CELDEF, the Community Legal Defense Fund. Many remember him as an inspiring teacher at CELDEF's ongoing democracy schools. Here's my introduction to the original broadcast of his one-hour speech. This is the second part of a one-hour talk on the question of how to bring about the changes we want in self-governance, be it energy, agriculture, health, or transportation. How to get away from the exhausting single-issue work on toxins or corporate destruction of the environment or labor rights or even peace and bring about lasting and fundamental changes. Richard Grossman argues that there is much to learn from the abolitionist movement of the 1800s. Instead of advocating for better working conditions for slaves, they decided to refer back to the principles laid down in the Declaration of Independence. Slavery was not about excesses and abuses, but the fundamental denial of human rights that all democratic governments were instituted to protect and all human beings entitled to just by being born. The abolitionists set out to end slavery and change the Constitution that protected the slaveholders. Now you will hear Grossman's description of how corporations became the dominant institution of our time and how that dominance also needs to be challenged in the constitutional arena. Here is Richard Grossman.
Fortuitously, but somewhat logically, I chose the corporation as my point of entry. Logically, because it was the dominant institution of our era, it has been for the last 100 years. And we lucked out, because what we found is it leads us into everything. It goes back to the nation's founding, it goes back to the Constitution, it's about law, it opens up to people's movements, it's in the context of rights. It's very hard to look at how the corporation evolved in the way it's evolved without going back to the Constitution and seeing that at the time of the ratification of the Constitution, the majority of bipeds in the 13 states were defined as non-persons, as not having rights. Right? Women, native people, white men without property, slaves, and most even free African Americans in the northern states, most didn't have fundamental rights. So that one of the most significant aspects of U.S. history that was in place and is still in place is the struggle of the rightless for their rights. And those struggles, of course, are still going on. And yet, we start off with a relative few. And as the abolitionists understood, we start off with a slave state and a slave constitution, right? Empowering a relative few, North and South, able to replicate the kind of institutions and their values throughout the society, driving the laws that they wanted to drive. That has built up quite an accumulation of law and culture, which each generation struggling for their rights comes up against. One of the things that we traced was the evolution of corporate charter theory to regulatory law. And the history is actually quite clear that up through the Civil War, more or less, the chartering process worked as follows, that the states chartered corporations through legislative laws, for the most part, and kept these corporations on a very short leash, limited the amount of capital they could have, limited amount of property. Corporations were chartered for single use that was specified. They were chartered for a limited time period, 10, 20, 30 years, not in perpetuity like today. There was no limited liability for shareholders. They were liable for debts and harms that the corporation caused. It was all part of an understanding that when people came to the legislature and applied for a charter, that this charter was a privilege if the legislature chose to give it. The charter was a privilege. And that they, having had experience with the East India Company and the Hudson's Bay Company and many of the European charter companies that were set up since the 1600s, and with some of the colonies that were corporations, business corporations, like the Virginia Corporation and the Carolina Corporation, the Carolina colonies were corporations, and the Massachusetts Bay Corporation. Having had experience with those entities, they saw how quickly those overpower their creator. And so the theory of the chartering laws that held fast until the Civil War was that we'll give you this privilege of a charter, we'll make the terms, the state will make the terms, and the corporation will not be part of the political structure, will not be lobbying, will not be doing all kinds of things. We'll give you a charter to do this task, and you do it. And if you exceed your authority or you violate the terms of the charter, we'll revoke the charter. By the end of the 19th century, that whole theory and structure have been thrown out. Led by basically New Jersey and then Delaware, you had corporations being chartered in perpetuity for, quote, any legal use. Gone were the limits on property holding. Gone were the limits on capital. Gone were the time limits. I would say that by the beginning of the 1900s, the corporate state was very much in place, and that the corporations had become the dominant institutions and were dominating the state. And they had actually created what I would call a corporate constitution. I mean, given that that has been in place for over 100 years, when communities in 1980, 1990, in the early part of the 21st century, begin to find themselves resisting what corporations are trying to bring into their communities, or resisting what corporations are driving into the country as a whole, what they find is that they're running into that whole history of corporations being wrapped in the Constitution, of corporations having more power than their own creators, than the states that they create. They run into this dual reality where the corporations have more power, and yet their own municipalities have been slowly but surely stripped of governing authority, of police power, and of authority to make the rules. Because when a community makes some rules that run into the so-called constitutional rights of corporations, the corporations just turn to particularly the federal state courts, but particularly the federal courts for vindication, and they usually get it. It's settled law. Of course, corporations have constitutional rights. Of course, they have First Amendment rights. Of course, they have Fourth Amendment rights, and Fifth Amendment, and Sixth Amendment, and 14th Amendment rights. Of course. When a community, or any civic group, really, when it forms to deal with some kind of corporate assault, a factory farm, a quarry, a toxic incinerator, a dump, an effort to remove a law like a predatory lending law, the very first thing that this community or group will run into is the law of the land. Because the law is not on the side of the communities. It's on the side of the corporations. And so we found ourselves looking to the abolitionists very much to understand, to talk about this, to put this in context, to give it words. I just wanted to mention some of the Ohio folks that were very active in the Western Anti-Slavery Society: Joshua Giddings, Philomen Bliss, John Bingham, William Lawrence, some of whom became radical Republican congressmen in Congress after the Civil War, who helped to write and then drive the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments into the Constitution. They were very clear that slavery was not about excesses or abuses, that it was about a denial of the fundamental protection of human rights that all governments, all free governments, were instituted to protect, and that all humans were entitled to just by being born. Like I said, they were not going to the slave masters and saying, would you please cause a little less harm? Would you please be a little nicer? They drove it into the most fundamental political arenas, the constitutional arena. For example, the federal government not only had the moral obligation, but the bounden duty to free the slaves and protect the great fundamental civil rights from abridgment in and by the states. They were talking about the government acting affirmatively. William Lloyd Garrison, who was the publisher of The Liberator for almost 40 years, came out every week for 40 years. On July 4th, 1854, standing on a platform in Framingham, Massachusetts with Henry David Thoreau, produced a copy of the Fugitive Slave Law, set it on fire, and burned it to ashes. Then, holding up the U.S. Constitution, he branded it as the source and parent of all other atrocities, and also consumed it to ashes on the spot, exclaiming, "So perish all compromises with tyranny." In Ohio, in Lorain County, an anti-slavery society meeting resolved the following. And listen carefully to the language. 1846, this is still, 14 years before the Civil War. "That slavery, by interfering with the rights of conscience and restraining a portion of their countrymen from the free exercise of religious privileges, is a gross violation not only of the laws of God, but of the Constitution of the United States and of every state of the Union. Resolved that we regard the union of these states as an invaluable blessing, but that one of the most important benefits of this union is utterly destroyed when the Constitution, which binds the states together, affords no protection to the lives of citizens out of the state in which they reside. Therefore, that the people of the United States are the source of the government, and that every citizen must be chargeable with the sin of slavery who does not make appropriate efforts to do it away." Something else, one more quote from The Liberator, from Garrison. "There is much declamation about the sacredness of the compact which was formed between the free and slave states on the adoption of the Constitution. A sacred compact, forsooth. We pronounce it the most bloody and heaven-daring arrangement ever made by men for the continuance and protection of a system of the most atrocious villainy ever exhibited on earth. No body of men ever had the right to guarantee the holding of human beings in bondage. Who or what were the framers of our government that they should dare confirm and authorize such high-handed villainy, such a flagrant robbery of the inalienable rights of man, such a glaring violation of all the precepts and injunctions of the gospel, such a savage war upon the sixth part of our whole population?" 1832, he was speaking that way. Among the jobs, the tasks of the abolitionists was to help people to see what was happening, to see what was in the mist. It's often said that fish discover water last. They were living within this system. It's extraordinary to go back and read the tracts, even the erudite tracts, even coming out of the North, rationalizing slavery, going back to Rome, quoting the Bible, quoting all these learned people, quoting all these religious people, these, footnoted, beautifully produced tracts rationalizing, justifying slavery as the highest form of civilization, enabling the truly deserving to live lives of leisure and learning and contribute to the well-being of the world. There was so much complicity in the wealth. There was so much complicity in the process all over the country that even people of goodwill didn't see. And when the abolitionists set out in the early 1830s, at a time of increasing slavery revolts and Underground Railroad, where African Americans, free and enslaved, were in fact violating the law whenever they could, were resisting, sometimes with violence, they had an enormous job to do. And what has impressed me the most is that it took them 30 years to frame this stuff out, to figure out what the problem was, to argue it out, so that when, in fact, the opportunity presented itself, which was never going to be self-evident that it would at the end of the Civil War, that they had the opportunity to fundamentally change the Constitution, which they thought they did. They thought that after they had driven the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments into the Constitution, and those were ratified, that they had changed the plan of governance from a property and commerce document to a rights and liberty document. It's very logical and rational that they should have thought that. But they didn't figure on what was going to happen next. And what happened next was that the rising corporate class in the North joined with the former slave masses of the South to destroy Reconstruction, to end that experiment, what some people call the Second American Revolution, and bring about a country with rights for all, where the government's role was to vindicate rights, not just the rights that were abused by government, but also rights abused by so-called private parties. The theory of the Bill of Rights is that it only functions on government. Congress shall pass no law abridging freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. Congress shall pass no law. In the 20th century, the courts have applied those to the states through the 14th Amendment. But they don't apply to private parties. And guess what institution of our era is considered a private entity? The business corporation. So, those of you who work for a corporation, as soon as you cross the property line, you give up your constitutional rights. You have no freedom of speech. You have no due process of law or equal protection of law. You have no freedom from unreasonable search and seizure. A corporation is a dictatorship. There's no such thing as rights of employees in a corporation. What does this do culturally to us and socially? The dominant institution of our time is a dictatorship by law. Its employees have no rights. They have only the privilege that the directors choose to give them. It's also, the entity has been wrapped in the Constitution through a series of decisions starting with the Dartmouth College case in 1816 and going through Santa Clara in 1886 and Minneapolis versus Beckwith, a whole slew of others, including and up to the 1960s and 70s, because the First Amendment, the corporations weren't wrapped in the First Amendment until the 1960s and 1970s, given free speech. How did we get to opening up this history? Well, we started something called Democracy School. We developed a curriculum, and we started these schools, and people actually started to come. We've done 100 of these schools now in Pennsylvania and about 20 other states. We need to look at this, what's going on here, not as a corporation here or a corporation there that does something bad or isn't so good. We're talking about a corporate system. It's a system around which the whole of the United States is structured, and increasingly the world, of course. It's a system. And it pops down in our communities. That's where it lands to do its work, because it's got to put its toxic dumps here, it's got to put its factories here, and it's got to put its banks here, and it's got to do its this. I mean, it has to come into real life and come into contact with the earth and with people. How have we, and I include myself, and how have we been dealing with this? Well, we try to regulate corporations. We try to appeal to the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and zoning laws and the National Labor Relations Act. None of those are about rights. None of those are about self-governance. None of those even acknowledge this history that we've been talking about. None of them provide an arena to talk about this stuff. Once you enter a regulatory proceeding under the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act or some kind of zoning issue or land use issue, sprawl issue, whatever it is, and you try to go into that proceeding and say, we consider the granting of constitutional privileges and authority to corporations as unconstitutional and immoral and wrong. There's no room for that at that hearing. It's not on the table. It's not about rights. It's about we bring in our experts to talk facts, and they bring in their experts to talk facts, and then we're going to talk facts. We're going to talk parts per million. We're going to talk how many trucks. What's the truck traffic outside the proposed Walmart Corporation thing? Are they going to destroy some wetland? Are there too many lights? Whatever it is. It's not about, does our community, does our jurisdiction, our government have the authority, doesn't our community have the authority to say no? And the authority to say yes to what we want. There's an accumulation of history, of law and culture, which is standing in the way of democratic self-governance in this corporate state. And that by seeking corporate, you know, asking corporate directors to be socially responsible, passing laws even to get them to be accountable, like the Sarbanes-Oxley law, you know, to have better accounting, and of course CEO has to sign off on all the numbers. None of that is about rights. None of that is about self-governance. None of that is about opening up to reveal the reality, what abolitionists had done, to deal with this phenomenon of fish discover water less, that we're immersed in this system. And so what we're trying to do with the Legal Defense Fund is work with communities that want to make it visible. And the process is we help create, working together with communities, we create some very stressful moments. Because as soon as they start talking about passing laws to ban, say, corporations owning farmland or practicing farming, passing laws banning longwall mining or sludge spreading or dredge dumping or whatever the issue of the moment is, the first person to speak up in the town to say you can't do that is the town lawyer. He says, you can't do that. That's unconstitutional. And so they have to overcome him or her. They have to overcome their town officials in many places. Sometimes the state attorney general in Pennsylvania has chimed in. You know, said, I hear you're trying to do such a thing, and I want you to know that we will not tolerate that. For the factory farm stuff in Pennsylvania, the corporations went to the legislature, and which finally passed a law preempting these laws, specifically preempting. And now the Attorney General of Pennsylvania is suing those communities. So that the full power and wealth of the state is coming in, going after these small townships. So in closing, I want to say that we're evolving. We've been through many stages of this work. And one thing that's becoming clearer and clearer to me, that the goal is really people. And I think it's very similar to how the abolitionists viewed their work. The goal is engaging more and more people in these conversations. The goal is helping each other to uncolonize our minds. Our goal is to help each other to think so that we can see what it is we're immersed in. So that, in fact, when we come together committed to actually do some organizing, to do some work, to pour our energy and our courage and our commitment into some communal effort, that if we win, it actually wins something. And if we lose, we also win because it reveals what's going on. It's not about passing a law that once it's passed won't make any difference whatsoever. Or passing a law, going through a process that only affirms the settled law that corporations, corporate directors, this minority of people running corporations have constitutional rights, have more power, that corporate business corporations have more governing authority and power than our municipal corporations, than our own communities where we live. And again, if we don't have democracy where we live, in our own small communities, you think we actually can have it in our states or in the United States? So the work is, it's a very human-centered, human-oriented work. And it's about us. It's what kind of people, what kind of citizens, what kind of earthlings do we need to be? You know, what is the work of humans in this world, in these very difficult times? What is the work of humans? And can we do the work of humans, that humans need to do under this Constitution, under our state constitutions, under our state corporate laws, that in fact tie our hands, that array our own governments against us? Remember what I said before, when a community or a group comes together to try to resist some kind of corporate act that they don't want, the very first thing they run into is the law of the land and public officials enforcing the law against them. And I think just as the abolitionists and other movements as well, other struggles, concluded that they could not achieve the goals that they wanted to achieve under the existing form of government, plan of governance, under the existing constitution, under the existing set of law, I don't believe that we can move to sane and ecologically sound and just transitions in all the realms we need to move, in energy, in food, in health, in military spending, in war and peace, in foreign policy, in transportation. We cannot do that with all these barriers in place, with the law in place, never mind the wealth of the corporations, with the law enabling the corporations to deny our rights on a routine, mostly invisible basis. So the work is about us. It's about humans, about people. That's what makes it so exciting. And it makes it so exciting to work with communities in Pennsylvania and other places. We all start changing each other. It's a very cross-fertilization evolutionary process. We're all at the very beginning, at the very, very beginning. For people who came looking for a quick fix or a silver bullet, we don't have that. For people who are interested in engaging in the work of humans on this earth, in undoing what has to be undone in order to get to where we want to do, I invite you all to come and join us. Thank you very much.
That was the conclusion of a one-hour talk by Richard Grossman, the preeminent anti-corporate campaigner. It was given at Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio, in November 2006. Richard Grossman died of cancer in November 2011, and I hope this remembrance keeps his inspiration alive. In the last 15 years of his life, Richard Grossman had been an important member of POCLAD, the Project on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, and CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. His lasting legacy are the democracy schools that continued to be taught across the country. Come to TUC Radio's website to find links to Grossman's pamphlet, Taking Care of Business, and two important documents from the last weeks of his life, one about criminalizing the practice of hydrofracking for natural gas, and another to withdraw all legal protections from corporations. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order a CD of Richard Grossman on What the Abolitionists Teach Us About Challenging Corporate Rule by calling 1-703-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.